Leandro Murillo y Luis Alberto Castaño. Desde la ciudad de Los Palacios, mi querido México, la amiga y compañera Daniela Villegas, periodista y maestra en estudios de género. Y desde esta cabina de radio, nuestra queridísima Madeline Speed, mi compañero Sergio Pochón y quien les habla, su amiga Hilda Venegas, nos despedimos deseándoles una noche de paz y justicia social para nuestros pueblos, que si el presente es de lucha...
You listen to Back in the USSR.
Let me give you a little faith footnote. Turn your neighbor say faith footnote.
Once again, it's the welfare. Consistently on our jobs. Ho! Shouts to the affiliates, man. Puerto Rican production, how we do it?
Continue to spark this. A black star shining like Marcus. So far to the left where Fark is. Left and field, we got enough mileage out of marches. And we give a perspective on community that reaches far deeper than these monsters. So of course I don't give a fuck about their bullshit, subpoenas, fabricated charges. Any signs of justice in this country are simply mirages. Cause freedom and America are not synonymous. A fact that polar opposite. So I don't wanna hear a word about that Obama shit. Death penalty, he won't abolish it. Ask him about his really defiance of Geneva Convention, he won't acknowledge it. Talk to him about Mexico right to the original land, he'll look at you in astonishment. But if you bring Afghanistan, he'll try to convince you to abominate. Don't tell me he's down with the people because of that ganja shit. Cause imperialism put a black face at the head of American imperialism, ponder it. And any illusions of our people's freedom, he now conjures it. Even some of our deepest MCs have been to seize on the fist. Some electoral rally go yonder with these pacifying functions we just don't bother with. It's egregious, it's so facetious, deceiving regard to change we can believe in. If it turns a deaf ear on real people grieving. Obama's support comes on the right wing of the Democrats, or where he's at. A warmonger with the same hunger to preemptively attack. White master with a skin that's black, in fact, Barack hopes to continue this borderless war. Find a kind of over the map.
Shouts to everybody. Yo, East Harlem, the West Oakland, baby. The Bottoms. Shouts to the PLC, CJRIC, Chairman, Spell Structure. Peace, yo, listen, check. Allow me to sit for a second and commence the rip. Then the shred fragments and bits are the bullshit they tryna get. We got munitions with banana clips, AK-47s with the winning grip. Derringers with our name tips to bring retribution for spaceships. A jungle when our hunger brings guerrilla warfare. We are Vietnamese in a tunnel, got you in our crosshairs and door fair. Squeeze off in this place air, blow your head clean clear. Off your shoulders, we are soldiers in dangerous pieces like coaches, we don't care. So yeah, I'll cast the first stone, rock and pebble too. Fuck it, homie, I'll be shot putting boulders at your vestibule. You got your own, not I, neither diplomat nor scholar or Obama. Just a wild motherfucker who wants to blow me. Neck palm with sweat to show you how wild the poor people get when a horn with his left to struggle and stress. Deep in his heart, a line is got like a line. I've slept. I'm so deadly. Check my plan, Ray. I'm so ready to come out. Send me with my hand. God is so steady.
Terrorism. We bombed Grenada and killed innocents.
and civilians, babies, non-military personnel. We bombed the black civilian community of Panama with stealth bombers and killed unarmed teenagers and toddlers, pregnant mothers and hard-working fathers. We bombed Gaddafi's home and killed his child. Blessed are they who bash your children's head against a rock. We bombed Iraq. We killed unarmed civilians trying to make a living. We bombed a plant in Sudan to pay back for the attack on our embassy. Killed hundreds of hard-working people, mothers and fathers who left home to go that day not knowing that they never get back home. We bombed Hiroshima. We bombed Nagasaki. And we knew far more than the thousands in New York and the Pentagon. And we never batted an eye. Kids playing in the playground, mothers picking up children after school, civilians, not soldiers. People just trying to make it day by day. We have supported state terrorism against the Palestinians and black South Africans, and now we are indignant because the stuff we have done overseas is now brought right back into our own front yard. America's chickens coming home. Begets violence, hatred begets hatred, and terrorism begets terrorism. A white ambassador said that, y'all, not a black militant. Turn back to your neighbor and say, footnote is over. Now, come on back.
Listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried Berezov. That was the Welfare Poets with Let It Be Known. And one of the things that certainly should be known is the fact that in Canada, here in Canada, we of course live in a settler state. The fact that we live on stolen Indigenous land is something that cannot be emphasized enough. That is what this country was built upon. You know, and anyone who says otherwise, whether that's Stephen Harper or Justin Trudeau or whoever else, of course, is a liar. And a manipulator. Now, of course, one of the experiences that I had personally, just before I attended the People's Social Forum in Ottawa, just this past month, in August, I had the experience of going to an occupation, a small occupation, relatively small occupation by a band of Indigenous people in Gatineau, Quebec. This is something that did not make the mainstream news, needless to say. And yet, it was just as important as every other confrontation or showdown that has ever taken place. For the decades now, the Indigenous people have been fighting back against the Canadian state that took their land from them. And basically forced them into reservations. You know, stole their children away, put them in residential schools. You know, expelled them from the land so that they could build their railways, their factories, their mines. You know, their cities, all of these things. And of course, as a person of European descent living on stolen Indigenous land, I have to recognize my own privilege. And I myself and my own ancestors have benefited from what effectively was a conquest of a continent. This is very important to understand. And like I told my students when I was teaching in China, I cannot call Canada my motherland until the Indigenous peoples of this land, the first peoples of this land, have self-determination themselves. You know, because the Chinese people who have lived on their land for thousands and thousands of years, who are very proud of their land, call it their motherland. You know, they do not live on stolen land. That land is theirs. I cannot say the same thing for myself, as a non-Indigenous Canadian citizen. I simply cannot, in all honesty. Okay, so this is basically what I'm going to do. I'm going to basically tell you about what happened to me last month. It was a very eye-opening experience for me, attending this, going to this Indigenous occupation in Gatineau. When I was staying, of course, with Patrick. You know, me and Patrick are the ones who went to this. You know, there are times when the power of a culture can make time stand still. The elder of the Cree Nation spoke to me of the sanctity of fire, and I, a settler on stolen land, had to struggle to find an adequate response to stories and traditions that seemed, in that moment, to be as old as the Ottawa River itself. See, this occupation took place on land, but, you know, where the Gatineau River meets the Ottawa River. And these stories and traditions, of course, were born countless thousands of years before European imperialism's chosen killers came bearing their guns, germs, and steel. However, in meeting with this old man at the site of the occupation where the Ottawa and Gatineau rivers combine, I am happy to say that I had the knowledge and the memory to reply with the example of Beltane, the ancient Celtic fire festival, from the days long before this monstrous colonial enforcement agency known as the White Race was ever invented to stain the moral fabric of the European peoples and set them against the rest of the world. Now, this elder was one member of a small band consisting of people from several indigenous American nations, coming from as far away as the Yukon and the southern United States, to stand in solidarity with the local Algonquin, Anishinaabe, and Mohawk peoples who were struggling to protect a sliver, just a sliver, of their ancestral land and ancient heritage, and to protect it from destruction. See, the city of Gatineau, like many cities across Canada that are undergoing gentrification, was developing its waterfront, and in the process of building a new boardwalk and installing new sewage systems, they uncovered a veritable treasure trove of Aboriginal artifacts, which, to their shame, they initially tried to rebury and cover up. But fortunately, news of the find leaked, and pressure from Aboriginal groups and local residents led to a limited archaeological excavation of the site, which was still uncovering artifact after artifact, even as the Gatineau city government closed it down and moved in its bulldozers. This was a limited archaeological excavation. They only had a few days to do it, and they were still kept just uncovering just more and more artifacts from thousands of years ago. Thousands of years ago. You see, the assembled nations, First Nations, refused to allow the legacy of their ancestors to be buried under concrete without a fight. Preliminary tests revealed, you know, preliminary tests by archaeologists revealed that many of the artifacts were between 3 and 6,000 years old, including stone and bone tools and copper spearheads that came all the way from Lake Superior, revealing the existence of ancient Aboriginal trade routes in the area. So unwilling to let this heritage be lost, they occupied the site of the excavations and refused to allow construction to continue until guarantees were given that their ancestors would be treated with respect. This goal seemed to be achieved when, in a public meeting on August the 20th, the city government, wary of negative publicity, agreed to consult with the First Nations in every step of the development process and to ensure that any further artifacts uncovered would be properly excavated and preserved in cooperation with the Ministry of Culture. It remains to be seen whether these promises will be kept, and I know Patrick, he went down there to the site a few days ago, and he basically found out that the city government had not been keeping its promises. They had not been consulting with the Aboriginal bands, the Aboriginal groups that had been assembled there to try to, to try to basically force the local government to really keep their promises and respect the site. So it looks like the city of Gatineau did not keep its promises on this matter. However, what struck me during the time I spent at the occupation site myself, and I was there for about 2 days, was just the collective strength of the people who decided to make a stand there. It's important to remember these people have survived. You know, the indigenous people of North America have survived the barbaric genocide of their nations and the conquest of their land. And in surviving, they have learned how to stand together They've learned how to stand together and fight back against the common enemy of imperialism and settler colonialism in a way that few other peoples in the world have. In Gatineau, they gathered and joined hands from all over the North American continent to resist the onslaught of this common enemy with their blood and with their spirit. And sandwiched between two upscale restaurants. You know, it's true. There was an basically a luxury restaurant on one side of the encampment, and on the other side there was this you know, upscale pub, if you want to call it that, or bar. And the occupation camp in between these looked so small. You know, there's only ever a few dozen people there at a time. But nonetheless, it was the embodiment of an alliance of risen nations that had, in the name of dignity and self-determination, united to occupy land that they had never ceded in the first place. And thus it was part of a much larger national liberation struggle involving blockades, protests, and occupations across Canada and beyond. You know, when I was there, a Palestinian activist, you know, came to the camp to express his solidarity, and he openly pointed out how similar the Palestinian struggle for self-determination, how similar it is to the ongoing struggles of the First Nations in Canada. You know, and as I found out myself, it turns out the Mohawk people of the Ottawa region, who had been forcibly confined to a reservation in what is now the city of Hull, only to lose it, along with their official status in 1903, you know, they no longer have status under the Indian Act. I mean, these people basically are non-status people, as many people are, especially in urban areas in this country. And they're now challenging the government of Canada before the Supreme Court to try to regain their ancestral claim to the land. Now, I'm really not sure about the status of that court case right now. But certainly they have taken it all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Mohawk people are trying to reclaim their dignity, you know, reclaim the land that was stolen from them. I say in 1903, they were forcibly evicted from their reservation in what is now Hull, and basically they were forced to live in slum areas, basically. But it's important to understand that this is not only about them. It's not only about the First Nations people here. It's also about us as settlers on this conquered territory that the imperial overlords of the British Empire and the capitalist interests that they serve forcibly carved out of stolen Aboriginal land on the basis of guns, smallpox, forced starvation, residential schools, racist laws, and sham treaties that they had no intention of honoring. It's very interesting. Recently I was reading, in fact, like a People's History of Canada, in fact. Like, it was basically Stanley Ryerson. Basically, he was a Marxist historian back in the 1950s, and he wrote a history of the Canadian, effectively about the origins of Canada, basically. And he talked about just the cynicism, the utter cynicism the British government treated the entire treaty process that they had with the indigenous peoples of this land, you know. Basically, they made all these promises they had no intention of keeping, and as soon as they had signed the treaty, they proceeded to evict the indigenous peoples from the land and move in the white settlers. You know, and basically the entire thing was an exercise in trickery and deception, and then, of course, forced expulsion of whole populations. That's basically what it was about. So now, I myself, as a man of European descent, born and raised in Canada, I was educated basically to be an enforcer for the settler colonial system built to reinforce the profits of the capitalist class by privileging a segment of working people to physically and culturally beat down the others. And of course, we've seen, I talked about that last week in the context of the United States, how very early in its history, people of European descent in the United States were privileged under the law in order to divide and conquer the working class in the United States, to like separate people of European descent and people of African descent. You know, and something, of course, similar exists in Canada, you know, with regard to, you know, people of European descent and people of, you know, indigenous people in this country. You know, a divide and conquer strategy is being pursued by the powers that be, by the ruling class interest, by the wealthy elites. And that's been going back centuries now. I mean, this is what they do. They basically privilege a certain segment of the working class, you know, people of European descent, and then basically try to convince them that their real enemy is not the ruling class itself, by the people who exploit them and you know, pay them, you know, starvation wages and, you know, don't give them and cut back on benefits and, you know, force them to live in basically in terrible conditions. It's not them. It's not the people who exploit them. You know, the people are. It tries to convince them that the people who, that their real enemy are the people who follow different cultural traditions or are a different ethnicity. You know, and this is a time-honored tactic that the ruling class uses around the world, trying to divide working people of different ethnicities and different backgrounds. And certainly that was done here. You know, effectively, yeah, and of course, Aboriginal peoples, they're the greatest victims of this evil class order. You know, effectively, like, you know, to be raised as part of a settler state, you know, to be brought up as a person of European descent in this country is effectively to be raised to be a little monster in the service of big monsters. You know, and many people in the European descent in this country have long forgotten what it means to resist, because like the Israeli settlers in Palestine, we have been trained to act as oppressors and to view oppression as normal. So we don't question it. But of course, there's more to it than that. For too many of the European settlers who arrived on these shores, including my own, were victims of imperialism themselves. In the case of my own Irish ancestors who arrived in Canada in the 1840s, after fleeing the genocide being waged against their nation by the British Empire, if they had actually sat down and conversed with the people of the Mohawk or Cree nations, they would have discovered that they had a lot more in common than they realize. Indeed, they faced a common enemy. My European ancestors who stood up against Westminster's legions and, you know, if you go back 2,000 years before that, the Roman Empire, you know, they knew what it meant to stand together against monstrosity, against imperialism. And it's horrific to see their sons and daughters converted into stooges of imperialism against other nations through the lies of settler colonialism and the white race. It is these lies that we must now reject. It is this spirit of resistance that we must now reclaim. Because it's important to recognize that before our ancestors came to this land as settlers, we were fighting back against imperialism. Many of us were. We were fighting back against ruling class interests in the countries of Europe. We knew what it meant to fight back and to stand in solidarity and to work together. You know, to build something better, to resist the powers that be. We knew how to do that. But over here, as settlers, we were privileged over the Aboriginal people and of course, over the descendants of the black slaves and over other, like, less and Hispanic people and other, like, people who did not have that privilege who were living in this land. So divide and conquer strategy was pursued and too many of us fell prey to it. So we stopped fighting back against the ruling class and started, like, instead preying on these non-privileged people living in this land. And this is a very conscious strategy pursued by the elite. And this continues to this day. So like I say, these are lies we must now reject. We must reclaim a spirit of resistance. You know, I'm talking to people of European descent here. In fact, the Battleship Potemkin should be Sergei Eisenstein's great film back in the 1920s in the Soviet Union. It should be a metaphor for all young people growing up within the context of the Canadian imperial state. The official history we're taught in school is a heritage we must reject. You know, the official history that downplays the invasion and conquest of a continent and tries to get us to believe everything is okay. And the whole process of, like, displacing the indigenous people of this land and bringing in settlers and, like, you know, exterminating people, that was just a natural process. You know, we need to reject that heritage. We need to reject that false history. Just as Lenin rejected the romanticized visions of feudalism that were in vogue in late 19th century Russia, even among some radicals. I would say mutiny is our duty. And like Lenin, who himself grew up in privilege, we must refuse to be little monsters for an evil system that can only survive by pitting working people of different ethnicities against each other. As Europeans living on stolen land, we can only relearn our true heritage of resistance, long eclipsed by imperialist illusions, by standing alongside and learning from these brave Aboriginal Canadians who have defied all attempts to erase them from the pages of history. For until they control their own destiny, until they have self-determination, we can never control our own destiny. For there to be justice at all in this land, for anyone, there has to be injustice. There has to be justice for indigenous people in this land. And those are the conclusions that I arrived at after attending that occupation in Gatineau, which is still ongoing. So very, very important to understand. And certainly I learned a lot. And I will be applying what I learned as I go forward in my activism, in my work with the Young Communist League and the Communist Party. I understand that to build socialism in Canada, we can only build socialism in Canada if we ensure that the Aboriginal population in this country has self-determination and controls its own destiny. Because like I said, that's the only way we're going to control our own destiny. We have to stand together. There has to be solidarity. That's what I want to stress to you today.
There's an inner thing in everyone, you know this thing, my friend. It has withstood blows a million years and will do so to the end. It was born when time did not exist and it grew up out of love. It cut down evils, strangling binds like a slashing, searing knife. It wept by the waters of Babylon and when all men were lost. It screeched in writhing agony and from bleeding. Well, it smiled in holy innocence at conquistadors of old, so meek and tame and unaware of the deadly power of gold. It burst forth through poor Paris streets and it stormed the old Bastille. And it marched upon the serpent's head and it crushed it beneath its heel. it down. It is found in every line of hope. It knows no bounds nor space. It has risen in red, black and white. It is dead in every race. It lights the dark of this prison cell. It thunders forth its might. If the unbuildable thought, my friend, that thought that says I'm right.
Listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Damian Dempsey with The Rhythm of Time, originally written by the Irish hunger striker Bobby Sands back in 1981. Who, of course, gave his life for the liberation of Ireland and the self-determination of his people. You know, and of course, it's people like, you know, and effectively, that is what the indigenous people of this land are fighting for. They're fighting for self-determination. You know, and that's just as real as the liberation struggle in Northern Ireland or in Palestine or, you know, wherever else in the world, anywhere else in the world you can think of, where people are fighting for self-determination. You know, that's happening here. And one of the things that I really think, one of the things I'm really going to explore tonight is just the reality of history. You know, the reality of the colonial conquest, which effectively, starting in 1492, with of course Columbus arriving in the Western Hemisphere and beginning what can only be described as probably the worst genocide in human history. You know, in the conquest of a continent by the empires of Europe, and the exploitation of that continent, the exploitation and destruction of the indigenous peoples of that continent. You know, it needs to be realized just how barbarous the entire process was. And I think to get that through to you, you know, I can't think of any better clip to play than, of course, this one discussion. It's called The Truth About Christopher Columbus. You know, it was done by Stephanie J. Adohi of the Workers' World Party down in the United States. And where, of course, Columbus Day is still celebrated. You know, effectively the man who began the European conquest of the Americas, you know, and the extermination of countless indigenous peoples is still celebrated in many parts of the Americas with a national holiday. You know, which is absolutely disgusting. You know, that an imperialist murderer like that is still celebrated. You know, and portrayed as a hero in parts of the Americas. You know, we need to fight against that. And the best way to fight against that is understanding what the truth is. What the truth is. You know, and that, of course, is what Stephanie J. Adohi does in this one talk she gave for Workers' World Party. So please have a listen, you know, because this is actually, I'd say this is an important education for us all. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
On October 12, 1995, BAI interviewed a progressive Italian-American historian. I think her name was Jennifer Guglielmo. I didn't write it down then. She stated that it was promoted by the Mussolini backers, and that at that time, the Italian working class was largely socialist and anarchist and had fought them in the streets. It was made a holiday in 1937. But let's go back to 1492, when Spain was in the Reconquista. They made war to expel the Moors, as we all know. Isabella and Ferdinand, they wanted new riches, trade, colonies. The conquistadores sailed on their orders. They bankrolled them. Christopher Columbus was apparently no Italian. His name was Cristobal Colon. He was a Spanish pirate. If the queen had known this, she'd have executed him. There's no evidence that he was ever in Genoa, the city he claimed. He read and wrote a lot, and of all his many papers he left, none of it's written in the tongue of Genoa. Okay, so he landed. He assessed the ready welcome of his friendly host, the Taino people, and he decided to attack, to kill, and take power. There are stories of him cutting off the arms of Taino men to feed to his war dogs. He wrote to the queen immediately to convince her of the idea of making them slaves. Yes, Columbus invented the slave trade. He said, they would make good servants. They're fit to be ordered about and made to work. And with 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want. Most of the slaves he sent back to Spain died quickly, and after a few years, Isabella and Ferdinand sent an investigator, Bobadilla, who arrived in Santo Domingo to find men jailed, lined up to be hanged as rebels. He ordered Columbus arrested at that time, and Columbus' personal cook, Espinosa, put the chains on him. Once the first reports came back to Spain from Pizarro and from Cortes about the gold and silver in Peru and Mexico and the slavery, a steady stream of conquistadors moved out, all of them bankrolled by the monarchs. The conquistadors, Columbus, Cortes, Pizarro, Oñate, Coronado, De Soto, and many others. From their contemporary descriptions by those who knew them, we could characterize them maybe as a kind of a lumpen, sort of completely out of control mercenary force. They were motivated by arrogance, religious superiority, and greed. They used the requirement, the requerimiento, I believe it's pronounced. It was a three-paragraph announcement by the Spanish monarchy and the church in Rome to submit to these men, their representatives, or else knives and guns would next be used. And that was their excuse for murder, rape, torture, robbery on a level never before seen, enslavement of whole indigenous nations in gold and silver mines, all in the name of the monarchs and the church. It's not possible for us to touch on all of them tonight, but I think it's important for all of us to know which ones are most hated still and which ones did the most damage. Isabella got wealth beyond all imagining. So did everyone who was with Francisco Pizarro, butcher of the Incas. Now, the Incas today, when we hear about them, they're either described as an empire or they're socialist and communist. We do know that they're the successors of an ancient farming communities which held land in common, and they were observed at that time distributing stores of supplies in the urban areas from warehouses to everyone in need, and they kept records of them. They gave supplies to the sick, elderly, poor, widows, and disabled. There's ruins at the city of Huanco who have 500 such warehouses that held over 1 million square feet of goods. The Incas were highly skilled in working gold and silver and platinum. They used a lot of bronze, but there was no iron available there. They were the world's finest weavers. They domesticated llamas and alpacas for pack, wool, meat. They were astute record keepers, but being weavers, they made all of their records with these intricate woven fringes of knotted string, and they had storehouses full of these archives of their records. They had advanced base 10 math with zeros and place notation. They had 14,000 paved roads running through the mountains, often stepped for the pack animals. Cusco at that time was 50 to 100,000 people, and there were a lot of smaller cities and towns. Pizarro, who was described by those who knew him as ruthless and devious, he tricked the Incas who had underestimated him based on reports that these were lazy robbers. He and his men attacked and killed 10,000 people at Atahualpa's court in an hour and a half. The court was unarmed because they had no fear of these men, and they fought to the last to defend themselves in Atahualpa, even as they cut their hands off and took him hostage. Atahualpa then offered the Spanish a personal ransom, a room full of gold and two of silver. For the next several months, llamas were carrying gold back from all over the Andes, from stripped temples and palaces. The outside walls of Cusco's main temple alone held a ton and a half of gold plates. The entire ransom came to 7 tons of gold and 13 of silver, all of it in the form of artwork and jewelry and so forth. It has been estimated at $65 million based on the price of $400 an ounce, and I think that's out of date. No king in Europe had ever seen or even heard of anything like this sort of wealth. And you know, the conquistadors, they just melted it all down. It took them about a month at a quarter ton a day. Pizarro then killed Atahualpa anyway and went on a rampage of plunder for more. In some buildings, they found 20-foot planks of silver. They took jewels off mummies. They killed so many people and the llamas that the public works and including the irrigation canals fell into decay and the llamas were almost exterminated. Spain and Portugal had signed a treaty, by the way, in 1494 to divvy up colonies, and Portugal got the easternmost part of Brazil and Africa, and Spain took everything this side. Spain at that point was getting $30 million in gold every year shipped over, so much so that it became a target for the English, French, and Dutch pirates. Francis Drake alone captured $40 million in gold. Spain used that gold for a series of wars against France and the Turks, and then in the war against Protestantism. By the time their armada was sunk, they'd spent the treasury, but their programs of colonization and missionaries continued long after. The huge amounts of gold that went to Europe that were stolen didn't just fund wars and more conquest expeditions. They changed Europe. The bourgeoisie had its role in outfitting these wars and missions. Huge quantitative change led to qualitative change in the power of the bourgeoisie as they grew, and it directly led to the rise of capitalism. And colonialism just exploded in size in utter immense robberies of previously unknown rapaciousness. Getting back to the conquistadors, Coronado. He was known for wandering all over the Southwest in search of the seven cities of gold and Quivira. He attacked, occupied, and burned several pueblos. And in fact, if any of you have been to the Southwest and visited some of the pueblos, what's left now is less than a third of what there was at that time. They were all the way into the Texas Panhandle. In the 60s, when I was a kid, my dad took me to see the site of a collapsed Kiva in the Panhandle. And if you're ever driving from Albuquerque up to Santa Fe and you go through Bernalillo, out west of Bernalillo, there's a park where you can go and see where there's one or two ruins there where Coronado personally burnt down the pueblos. Oñate, he was known for working thousands to death in the gold and silver mines in Zacatecas, and he left to take over New Mexico. He's hated to this day in New Mexico. He attacked Acoma Pueblo, which is known as like the Thousand Year City or whatever. I think some of you have been there. In 1599, when it rose up against the settlers, the Spanish killed 800 children, women, and men. Oñate then ordered every man over 25 to have a foot cut off and serve 25 years of slavery. Every female and male between the ages of 12 and 25 got 25 years of slavery. And 60 young girls were sent to priests in Mexico, never to return. To this day, they can't build a statue in New Mexico and all the way to El Paso without huge protests from the pueblos. And generally, eventually, those statues, there will be a foot sawed off, and no one ever knows who did it, you know? The one at the airport in El Paso, though, there was such protest against it that they just renamed Oñate the Equestrian. There were rebellions against Spain and the conquistadors. The biggest was in the Andes in Peru, led by Tupac Amaru No. 2. There were records of the Incas melting gold down and pouring it down the throats of the conquistadors they captured. But the second biggest was in what's today New Mexico in 1680. Some say it was the Spanish fear of snakes and dolls that led them to burn 1,000-year-old Kachina dolls of the pueblos. Others say it was the beating of Pope, who did lead the pueblos in the revolt, and they burnt out the Spanish and kicked them out for 12 years. Pedro de Alvarado, another mass murderer, worked thousands to death in Guatemala in the mines. He hanged every local leader who tried to protect the people. He enslaved so many that the price of an Indian slave fell to 1/20th the price being paid in Mexico. Hernando de Soto was Pizarro's lieutenant, and he'd grown up, and he was proud of it, killing Indians in Panama in his teens, killing Indians in Nicaragua in his 20s. His part of Atahualpa's ransom made him a millionaire in gold, but he wanted Florida. So he went to Spain, and he got the grand bankroll, and he paid for an outfit of 600 soldiers, 200 horse, numbers of African and Mexican slaves, war dogs, and several hundred swine, and these were actually war pigs because they were trained to root out fields and flush ambushes. They left Florida north to either the Smokies or the Blue Ridge Mountains, then across the Mississippi all the way to Arkansas. And they followed the roads that were established in the paths from town to city, stealing food, burning storehouses, fields, and towns and cities, kidnapping locals to enslave, and they burned them alive if they made trouble, cut their hands off if they didn't lead them to gold. They abducted the woman ruler of a city called Tolomeco in a state called Cofitachique, and nobody today knows if that was Jolagi or Cherokee or Creek, and killed her for her pearl necklace. The DeSoto Party recorded events, as all of these expeditions did. They saw cities and towns newly abandoned due to smallpox already spreading all over from the Spanish landings. They were the first and last outsiders to ever see the living Mississippian culture, which is today called the Mound Builders. Smallpox and seven other disease vectors that we now know lived in DeSoto's lost war pigs that went feral spread disease everywhere through the whole Mississippi Basin and all the tributary rivers upstream. He attacked the original city of Mobile and abducted the leader, a woman. There was a huge battle and Mobile burnt down. Mobile, Alabama is named after that. The Mississippi culture mounds that remain that you can see today were actually originally great earthen pyramids showing the influence of the Mayans and others. And the Mississippi culture depended completely on corn. They had miles and miles of crops of corn. Maize corn, by the way, was the first ever in human history selectively bred food grain in the world. And its scientific history is still being debated because it's so very different from the grass teosinte that people don't know today how the indigenous gardeners changed it from like a thumb-sized, nearly inedible seed pod to all the many varieties of maize corn that were being grown here by the time Columbus came. Maize corn was being raised up and down the East Coast, all over the Mississippi Valley, the Southwest, and more. And at the same time that agriculture was developing in Mesopotamia about 10,000 years ago in Peru in the Chilca Canyon, the potato was being domesticated and cropped. The word used in Spanish for potatoes, papas, is the original Incan word. By 1491, they had thousands of varieties in existence, one for every elevation going from the Andean peaks down to the valleys. The Incans preserved great masses of the potato papas crops by mashing them and freeze-drying them, and they'd last 10 years as a food store in case of the drought. And they did all of that with wooden tools. The stories that Native people took these unwashed armed men for gods is disproven over and over again by contradictory anecdotes. Incas thoroughly investigated these strange men, but they made the mistake of underestimating them in their disgust for their personal behavior and their filth. In 1502, Columbus accidentally encountered a large seagoing canoe the length of a galley off Honduras, and it was a Mayan crew. They ordered the Spaniards to get out of their way. It took the conquistadors till 1511 to figure out that the Mayans were 120 miles west of them. They were crushed at the first battle against them at, I'm not sure how to pronounce the name of the town, Champoton, 1517. But by 1519, the Spanish had begun to enslave Africans and bring them to Cuba, where subsequent excursions into the hemisphere now deployed also African slaves. There's a link in all of this with the fight against the racist use of the word savage in the anti-Muslim posters on the MTA. That and the word primitive have been used endlessly with that question for 520 years against all the indigenous peoples of the world. Columbus was savage. Capitalism, savage. Imperialism is savage, right? And we can use other words in place of primitive in our economic and political discussion, pre-class society, early accumulation of capital, original communism when we discuss humanity. Imagine the continual effect on the consciousness of just the use of these two words only over the last 200 years. People see it in literature and they accept it. People of color see it and resent it. Our youth are affected negatively, and so are our social relations with people outside our communities. The true fact is the term hunter-gatherer is generally also wrongly used. Perhaps it's accurate for the period when people around the world were first surviving the Ice Ages, but it's another way of saying primitive. All of humanity is adaptable and creative in learning to use the resources available and in their environments. These societies were gardening more than gathering. At some time after the last ice age in Asia and later in Europe, they domesticated livestock animals. Over here in 1491, what was actually going on across Great Turtle Island, North America, and the land of the condor, South America, was a whole hell of a lot of gardening, growing of crops, even in the forests. Over one half of all of the food crops in the world today, by numbers of species and by volume and weight, sold are indigenous to this hemisphere and were all domesticated by indigenous people, from popcorn to pumpkins, tomatoes, squash, all kinds of beans, maize corn, various berries and nuts, potatoes, chocolate, pineapples, cassava, the manioc, various palm oils, avocados, papaya, quinoa, amaranth, acai, and too many others to name, really. And all the chilies that the Spanish took all over the world that Columbus mistakenly named peppers. What's primitive about the cultivation of so many diverse food crops? What's primitive about Mayan and Incan development of the concept of the zero, of the astronomical sciences of all the ancient peoples of this world? Between 3200 and 2500 BCE, before the current era, large-scale public buildings were erected in at least seven places on the Peruvian coast. The only other urban center that we know of today at that time was Sumer on the Tigris-Euphrates. And then there's the fact that across this continent, people from small villages to cities lived communally. There were 500 nations, and most of them were still matrilineally structured. I mean, here within the U.S. alone. There's nothing primitive about a society which is so equal and free, yet completely functional, on the basis of no classes at all. And by the way, comrades and friends, Native women today typically use the word matrilineal because it doesn't imply a hierarchy. There are so many different and complex traditions of music, art, storytelling, dance, theater in our histories and still surviving. And about the agriculture, in Amazonia today in the forest, people can walk through and pick fruit to eat. Scientists tell us these are all old orchards. There were 138 crops just alone being grown in Amazonia, half of which were trees. Also, there were huge tracts of artificially built up soil. The Amazon has really bad acidic red soil. And by some today still unknown process, the people who live there in several different nations or communities created two types of very dark, nutritious soil, terra preta, for their crops, and they used charcoal, broken pottery, and probably animal and fish remains, and it provided all the needed nutrients for plants like phosphorus, calcium, sulfur, organic matter. The Amazon was being terraformed before 1492. Conservative estimates put that extent at a few thousand square miles, or 0.1 to 0.3% of the basin. That's about the size of the cropped land that the Mayans had. Others estimate up to 10%, which would be the size of France. In original communism or communalism, the form of the family was healthy and vibrant, and we call it the extended family. It provides all the support needed for the individual, for the children. Everyone knows they belong. People who are not related are adopted in as well. And there's no isolation of the self. There's no alienation from society like we see today to the detriment of our youth. By contrast, the nuclear family under bourgeois society is like a little piece of it got amputated and lacks support. The clash of cultures that began with the invasion of the conquistadors and continued with the invasions of the English and French and the Russians on the West Coast still had positive effects on the settlers, some of which enabled them to survive here, like the adoption of the food crops and various articles of clothing and other technology. The gender equality of the women was not understood or accepted by the Europeans, but they had been living under feudalism for hundreds of years. The National Women's History Project in the U.S. states many early women's rights leaders were inspired by what they call the Seneca's matriarchal society. And Ben Franklin has famously noted the impact of the Iroquois Great Law of Peace on the Constitution. and bathing was a daily practice. The British and French are often noted in records as being amazed at this because most of them had never had a bath in their lives. And the ideas that have been adopted from the fashions are too numerous to even go into. That'd be a whole other talk. But getting back to the smallpox, up until 1492, there was very little contact between these two hemispheres. No one here had any immunity to the diseases that were brought over by the invaders, precisely because these were diseases that jumped species from domesticated animals of Asia and Europe. Were rats. Half the Aztecs, half the Incas, and the Mayans died before the fighting in which they were overthrown. It was more severe than the Black Death, and it killed leaders, advisors, generals, and elders. Cortes lost the first assault on the Aztec capital, Tenochtitlan. Then smallpox hit for 60 days, leaving everyone too sick to even move. And those who survived when it began to diminish faced Cortes because he had come back by them. Disease traveled out from everywhere the Spanish and later invading forces had landed, and it traveled to every corner of the hemisphere. Okay, in 1491, it's been estimated that there were some 112 million people living in this hemisphere. The Mexican plateau alone, we know, had 25.2 million based on colonial records. And these diseases, smallpox, flu, measles, etc., killed 80 to 100 million people in 100 to 150 years. It works out to about 20% of the world's population at that time, as the UN figures that the world had 500 million people in 1600. Now, the work that was done by progressive scientists in the 50s and 60s to achieve this more realistic figure is still under attack by racists in their fields. By the time the English and the French arrived, the waves of smallpox epidemics had even left numerous villages of the dead, which the settlers found on the seaboard and across the land. Sometimes they just moved right in like the pilgrims. Decimated indigenous nations now faced waves of settlers anxious and mean with greed to steal the land and create wealth, and a totally alien perspective of the settlers and their view of the land, the environment, as something to be used and abused to make money as opposed to being stewarded and cared for to encourage the wealth of food and other resources that had been available. The indigenous nations fought back, but the fighting came long after the waves of death had shifted the balance of forces to the invaders. In 1776, we know most of the fighting wasn't against the British, it was against the Cherokee. The Americans burned 100 Chilagi villages to the ground and all of their crops to steal huge tracts of land from Virginia going south. And that whole nation was refugeed to the mountains with the shirts on their backs in the middle of the winter. And comrades and friends, did you know that today in Canada, they're honoring Tecumseh, the Shawnee leader, and a white general with tribute to saving Canada from U.S. takeover in 1812. And as all of us know, Marx and Engels were very excited to read the work of Lewis Henry Morgan, who was the first to write of the matrilineal societies in the extended family based on the Haudenosaunee. But most don't know that he met Tonawanda Seneca Ely or Eli Parker, I'm not sure how he pronounced his name, when they were both working as clerks in a bookshop upstate. He learned everything he knew from Parker, who was later General Ulysses Grant's right-hand man, the military secretary, who took the surrender at Appomattox. Going into the 19th century, the U.S. declared manifest destiny to take the West. We had the Trail of Tears, the California Gold Rush, the Plains Wars, and all of these wars and atrocities led up to the U.S. Becoming imperialist when it finally took on Spain itself in 1898. In 1891, Congress passed the Dawes Act to break up the communally owned lands of the reservations and mandated individual ownership, but in plots small enough to leave a lot of land left over for the Sooners in Oklahoma, plots too small to be viable as well. Ironically, only the Pueblos were protected from the Dawes Act because they were under the legal status of the Spanish land grants. The 1898 Curtis Act dissolved tribal governments and the courts. There are many undocumented people in Oklahoma, including full bloods today, who aren't able to be members because their ancestors refused to get on the rolls at a certain time and they didn't get their allotments. In Oklahoma, in World War I, when Eugene Debs was in jail under the Palmer raids, the biggest rebellion against the fratricidal war this side of the Atlantic took place, the Green Corn Rebellion, named after the Chilagi Cherokee New Year. Indigenous black and white farmers and workers came together to fight back, and they were suppressed by the National Guard. Today, capitalist society portrays all indigenous people as either completely wiped out and free to use for a Halloween costume, or only recognized if they fit a particular stereotype from Hollywood or whatever. There are so many local struggles that we never really even hear about. This is still Indian land, and the struggle continues. This is the significance of Day of Mourning. If you've never gone to Day of Mourning, I'd like to strongly urge you to get on the bus and come this year. You're going to hear from Leonard Peltier, who sends his support every year from prison in Florida this year. You'll hear about struggles across Great Turtle Island and how indigenous people view the current U.S. wars. And we salute Osceola, the leader of the Seminole Nation, the Creeks, the Southern Creeks, who had adopted the runaway slaves in Florida who never surrendered to the U.S. We look to the Green Corn Rebellion for our inspiration in the struggle, and we salute the United American Indians of New England, whose slogan is, "We're not vanishing, we are not conquered, we are a